Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2007. As I said, we're thrilled to have Julia Shulman with us tonight. Julius, who recently celebrated his 97th birthday, was born in Brooklyn and moved to LA with his family at the age of 10. Photography went from his hobby to his profession in 1936, when he was exposed to modern architecture for the first time on a visit to a Richard Neutra-designed house in the Hollywood Hills. Neutra, the architect, was so impressed with Julius's photos of the home that he immediately hired him to photograph additional projects, thereby launching an unanticipated and prolific career. We'll hear more about that career tonight as Julius is interviewed by Wim DeWitt, head of special collections and visual resources and curator of architectural collections at the Getty Research Institute. Wim moved to the U.S. in 1982 from Holland, and he has worked as a curator at the Cooper Hewitt Museum and also as a curator for architecture at the Chicago Historical Society. Wim and I have been also working on another public program in conjunction with the Shulman exhibition. That will be a panel discussion on January 23rd titled The Height of Ambition, New Development Downtown, a panel discussion which will include Lauren Bond, who is the originator of Farm Lab, an artist, Tom Gilmore from Gilmore Development, Martha Wellborn, Grand Avenue Committee, and architect James von Klemperer from Kahn Peterson Fox Associates. And the panel will be moderated by L.A. Times architecture critic Christopher Hawthorne. It should be great. We hope you'll join us that evening. And if you're a library associate, we'll give you advance notice of when our reservations are available online. Tonight, just a few notes. After the conversation between Wim and Julius, they'll be happy to take some of your questions. We'll have a microphone circulating in the audience, and please wait until it comes to you because we do record for future podcasts. Our book signing tonight, Julius will be signing books, just books only, please. We ask no memorabilia, and he's going to be signing on stage. So give us a moment after the program. We'll bring a table out. We'll line up here, and we'll have the book signing on stage. Please turn off your cell phones. Remember, no photography during the program. And now it is with great pleasure, please welcome Julia Shulman and Wim DeWitt to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Thank you very much, Louise, for your nice introduction. I also want to use this opportunity to thank all staff at the Public Library for their great collaboration with us on the exhibition. It has really been fantastic, and they are still taking good care of the exhibition, and it has been... Yes, please, applause for the library. Thank you. I also want to thank you, all of you, for coming, in spite of the traffic jams with the demonstration on 6th Street. And in the car, since it took so long, I had time to listen to programs, and I found there was great competition this evening. I was afraid that maybe you would not show up in the end, because it's not a very important literary event, that is Borat signing books at... in a bookstore in Westwood. And I do appreciate that you all decided in the end to come listen to Julius rather than buying a book about Kazakhstan. So we are going to talk about the exhibition and about Los Angeles. As you know, the exhibition's title is Julius Shulman's Los Angeles. And it deals with, it shows Julius's interaction with Los Angeles. His going to many places, actually in the whole world. He has photographed in almost all states. How many states did you go to?
45.
That's incredible. And also to other countries where he has worked. But Los Angeles has always been the spot that he has really done most of his work and where he really shines, I think, in his work. And it was fantastic for us to really go through the archive and to look for those best photographs. He has documented the city at a moment, much of which we have already forgotten by now, how much the city did change in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Now we are used to this area here to be all high-rise buildings. It was very different, as we will also see in some photographs that we are going to talk about. And thanks to Julius's work, we really can reconstruct and can understand what happened to the city right before the Second World War and in all those years after the Second World War. So I propose that we're going to talk about Julius and about Los Angeles, about what he likes about Los Angeles and about his early history in Los Angeles and how Los Angeles shaped his work. And at some point, I will also give you the opportunity to ask questions if you have them. And so we'll just go from there. I think heard Louise's introduction correctly. She already said that Julius was born in Brooklyn. He was born on a great date. Are there more people from Brooklyn here? Okay. Okay. He was born on 10-10-10, October 10, 1910. So he's now 97 years old, exactly 4 weeks since his birthday. And he was born in Brooklyn, but then early in his life, they moved to Connecticut. And you were a farm boy there, is that correct?
I was 3 years old when we moved, 1913, when my father decided to become a farmer. So he found an old farmhouse, Central Village, Connecticut, had 290 population. When we moved there from Brooklyn, New York, I had two brothers and two sisters, so we had five children and two adults, and the population of Central Village went up to 297. And when we left Central Village in 1920,
it dropped.
To take a train to go across the country to Los Angeles, the population went down to 290 again.
Maybe there were some children were added to that number in those years that you were there. But why did your family decide to leave Connecticut and come to Los Angeles?
My father had a friend who had moved from Connecticut to Los Angeles. And he kept writing to my father saying, "You've just got to come to California, Los Angeles, the streets are paved with gold." And the gold, of course, was the business opportunities. In 1920, the population of Los Angeles, for those who don't know it, in the census of that year, Los Angeles had 576,000 people. That population increased in 1930 census to 1,300,000, it doubled. So when my father came here in 1920, he exercised the opportunities that were waiting for him. Among other things, he started a small clothing business, but also he bought a small, or relatively small, orange ranch out in the boondocks, out near what is now Sierra Madre. Uh-huh. And in those days, you can get a company or franchise people who would obtain the property and take your orange grove, plant trees, cultivate trees, market the oranges. The navel oranges were big in those days, and I mean big as well. Uh-huh. And This is another world, and this air in California was fragrant.
So I had actually wondered about that, because your father had moved from Brooklyn, where I assume he was not a farmer, to become a farmer and then come here. And then did he all of a sudden, after those 7 years in Connecticut, did he give up farming altogether? But so he did still hold on to some of that.
Well, the Orange Ranch was great because he never had to do anything, but he took us out there. He had a friend that had a Model T Ford to drive the family out to see the orange grow.
Uh-huh.
And it was an amazing experience for those of us coming from Connecticut. My father raised corn and potatoes, and my mother took care of the cows, milking the cows, and feeding the chickens, and generally cooking on a wood stove. Seven people, three meals a day, five children and two adults, besides milking the cows and taking care of the small farm chores that she had to take care of, and raising a family.
Uh-huh.
It was an amazing experience, speaking of women in the early years, how they were capable. Imagine, no electricity in the house, by the way. No bathrooms. It was just an old two-story house with shutters on the windows to keep it warm in wintertime, because there was no heat in the house except on the wood stove in the kitchen. So those of you who may still complain about what a rough life it is, just think of my mommy.
Uh-huh, yeah. But I think for you, living on the farm was very important, also for your work later as a photographer, right? You learned things there, I think, is what you once told me.
Well, I was 3 years old when we came from Brooklyn, New York, to Central Village.
Uh-huh.
And my two brothers and sisters went to school, elementary school in downtown Central Village.
Uh-huh.
And so I was home alone with my father. My father was working with we had a horse named Nellie, and then Nellie pulled a plow, and my father would push the plow behind the horse, plant furrow and corn and potatoes or whatever. My mother took care of the smaller vegetables, as well as feeding the chickens and milking the cows.
Mm-hmm.
It's a strange life, but the farm was surrounded by forests of trees. New Connecticut has never grown, eastern Connecticut, close to the Rhode Island border, if you know Connecticut. Forests. And I used to wander around the farm, 3 years old, too young for school at that time. They didn't have any preschools, thank goodness. So, so I was able to stay home with my mother and walked around the farm and got lost in the cornfield or got lost in the forest around. My mother used to have to come to find for me. And we had a small pond at the end of the lake, the end of this forest, where the forest met our farm property. And my mother found me one day sitting on the side of the bank of the little pond talking to a little green water snake. And she always told me, she was delighted in telling the children at the dinner table that night how she found me talking to a snake. It was a great life.
Uh-huh.
But I was endowed with the beauty of nature. And again, we didn't have a symbol as some stupid person created the green environment. What is wrong with our society? We've always talked about how important it was for architects to design houses and buildings, recognizing the need for environmental relationship. Why this great hullabaloo about green, 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 like green on the exit signs? Who needs green? We already have environment.
Well, but we have destroyed a lot of our green, and that's why we want to make also our architecture green.
Whatever it was.
Anyway, then in 1920 you came to Los Angeles. What's your first memory of coming to this city? Do you remember coming by train?
Yes.
10 by then,
well,
or 9?
The train trip didn't mean much to a 10-year-old in those days. Because you sat in a coach seat, of course, and you ate a makeshift kind of meal, whatever. My mother used to have to herd us around to the bathrooms and everything. And so the train trip is not with memories. However, when we got here, we were wearing our Eastern warm clothing. And September in Los Angeles, even in those days, was hot, uh-huh. like it always is here in August and September. And first thing we got off the train, we took off our coats, which, by the way, gives me an idea. It's pleasant here. It's
warm under the lights.
We'll have to turn those lights down there when we have our show. There we go. I don't have my colored shirt. You don't mind, do you? All right.
So, but then you came to this city. Was it hard for a country boy to adapt to city life?
No, I'll tell you why. We lived on Alpine Street. Those of you who are familiar with Chinatown, by Hill North, Hill and North Broadway, Alpine Street's one of the streets that goes off of the Broadway and Hill up towards the west, towards Figueroa Street, Sunset Boulevard, in that area. And our school, Alpine Street, I was in the third grade. And incidentally, speaking of the third grade, I was 10 years old, 11 years old, whatever. The school used to bring students with a yellow streetcar, walk from Main Street up to the library. This library was here. Uh-huh. There was a Mecca. All the teachers brought students to this library.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh.
1920, uh-huh. 21, 22. This building has not changed. It's still the same. Uh-huh. It's a fascinating
Thank
experience.
Yeah.
And uh-huh. Los Angeles wasn't much in those days. Uh-huh. My father did buy a small hotel building down here at 9th and Grand. That area, between 8th and 9th Street. Small hotel, and I went to, that was later on when I went to junior high school. I used to be chored to go to the school after, go to the hotel after school, to sit at the desk, because they didn't have many guests, but still I sat at the desk to write things down and do my homework. But it's fascinating to realize that hotel is long, long gone because now it's occupied by a 50 or 60-story building. Uh-huh. It's a strange part of Los Angeles. And even when I spoke to the Downtown Businessmen's Bureau recently, not one of them was old enough to remember Los Angeles. One of the blessings I have, those of you who are in the audience, I don't see many beards. So you're all younger people. But those of you who are in their 20s and 30s, like Wim here, for example.
Yeah, right.
just think what you have in store for you. And I'm serious. Los Angeles is entering now into a new cycle. When I talked about my father having a hotel on 9th and Grand, or 9th, whatever it was, whatever street it was, just think. Rooms were $5 or $6 a night, and we had a few guests. I didn't have to collect any. I don't remember who paid what, but regardless, look how Los Angeles has changed today. On 9th and Grand, there's a building called the Lee Building. Harlan Lee was a builder, one of the first builders in Westlake Village. But he bought this old hotel at the time when loft were being developed in all the old abandoned office buildings downtown Los Angeles. Uh-huh. Remember I said 576,000 Los Angeles. This, my father's business was on Temple Street, where the freeway is now. And by Glendale Boulevard, which is a short distance away, you're on the edge of Los Angeles. Uh-huh. Los Angeles has grown miraculously.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And we're just beginning to burst out. And now Los Angeles is moving back, downtown Los Angeles, the mobile gas building on between 6th and Wilshire on Flower Street had 300 offices. Today it's occupied by 300 families. Uh-huh. It's all condominiums now. Yeah. Many office buildings downtown which were abandoned. And Art Gilmore was one of the first developers who recognized the future of Los Angeles.
I think we should put this even in more in starker perspective. This 87 years that Julius has been here. Julius once told me that when he came to LA in 1920, Pico Boulevard was still an Indian trail.
Practically.
That is.
It was a dirt road. The Boy Scouts, the troop we had, we used to take from Boyle Heights, we took the yellow car, the Brooklyn Avenue car, get off at Main Street and get onto the yellow car, the P car, P for Peter, and the end of the line was Pico and Rimpo. That's where Pico Boulevard ended from downtown. Then it was a dirt road, and we walked all the way from there to the beach to be, we'd hike all night to Santa Monica, and we took off our clothes and skinny dipped in the ocean.
Good for you.
There's no one on the beach. And this is the amazing thing about Los Angeles. There's no such thing as this Newport and Venice and all the other beaches we have. You don't realize sometimes how what a great city this has become. Too big if you see the traffic. My God, it took an hour and a half today, even taking my shortcuts. I'm doing an assignment for Huell Hauser, by the way. I'm telling him about my adventures, about how to have moved through Los Angeles without taking a freeway. Uh-huh. And we did that with a cab driver tonight. The limousine driver brought me to the freeway 101 at Cahuenga and Mulholland. And we got onto the freeway, and I said, wait a minute, we got to get off of that. We weren't moving. It was worse than a 405, it's 5 o'clock. It was exactly 5 o'clock. We still got here 10 minutes to 6. It was wonderful because we took shortcuts all the way down through town. Went east, and first we went south, then east, and south, and east, and finally got all the
way.
Made
it to the library.
We went to Temple Street, to Grand Avenue, turned down Grand Avenue, 5th Street, made a right turn on 5th Street, and there we parked the car.
Great. I want to come back to this hiking along Pico and being a Boy Scout. I think it's also influenced your early photography, and that's we have one of your early photos here, like before you officially started to work as an architectural photographer in 1936. This is like 1933 or 34, I think, right? Then you were still in Northern California.
This is in Lafayette, California, over the hills from the Bay Area. You pass through Oakland or Berkeley, and then you came over the hills. This is the valley. We're looking towards Orinda, Walnut Grove, Dublin, a whole series of small farm towns. My friend had a small ranch in what was called the town of Lafayette. Lafayette occupies all these hills today. Behind the trees in the distance is Orinda, mm-hmm. Walnut Grove. The valley is full of people. Look what it was. This is when I went to Berkeley from 1933 to 35. Look what happened. This was all, there wasn't a house in sight, just farmland or empty tree orchards. This is constant for the entire country.
Mm-hmm. So I thought I'd bring out one other early landscape photo because it shows how much you understood light, the California light. Is this also Northern California, or is this...
This is Death Valley.
This is Death Valley, okay.
And some of you may have noticed Los Angeles Times. By the way, if you don't read it, you should read the travel section and also the home section of the Times. But the travel section had a story about Death Valley recently. This is Death Valley, one of the many areas we explored in camping overnight, a week at a time, perhaps, during the Boy Scout days. We explored much of the state. It's a fascinating thing in this experience you have in a city like a country like this. Many of you don't realize the beauty of California. Los Angeles has, it doesn't take too much if you avoid the freeways.
But you once told me that when you take photos of a house, you explore it, and you know in order to take this shot, I have to be back at 12 minutes past 4 today, because you look at the sun and all that. You know that exactly.
Before 12.
Whatever, okay.
Oh, no, don't say whatever.
Okay. But what I mean is that you have an incredible sense of the light. And I've always wondered if that goes back to those early years of living on a farm, being a Boy Scout, hiking, and doing this early landscape photography.
Well, you knew where north was.
Uh-huh.
And you knew where the sun rose and where the sun set. Uh-huh. I can tell you stories about that another time.
Okay. So we are now going to look at photos from the exhibition and some others that I put in there to talk about Julius's interaction and, I think, love affair with this city. And this one is also actually early. This is also still before he officially became an architecture photographer. I heard that Louise told you the story about working, doing this one house for Richard Neutra. But this is also 1933 or 34. Why don't you tell about it, Julius?
In the 1930s, I had a Kodak Best Pocket camera, which was this little 127 size film, small images about 2 5/8 by 1 3/4 inch negatives, black and white, of course. And this was a view of downtown. I used to wander around the city taking snapshots. I had no inclination whatsoever. I got the camera because my older sister gave it to me for my 23rd birthday. So I took snapshots of everything I saw, which included the construction of the L.A. Municipal Union Terminal Station, which was, you see the steelwork in the foreground and the cement foundation. And the City Hall in the background had already been built. The Hall of Records, where the derricks are, they're building the federal building on the right, and behind that in the far right is the City Hall, is the jail, Hall of Justice, so-called. Okay.
But this is even though it's an early photo, it's already a very typical Julius Shulman photo. When you look at the composition, the way you place City Hall in the center of the photo, the reflection in the water. There are many photos that I know that you took where there is you can see reflections of the house in the swimming pool and things like that. Those kind of characteristics you see already here in this photo.
We had a tour last week, by the way, with a group of 30 or 40 photography students from Cal Arts,
yeah,
in the Valley. Uh-huh. They're all learning photography, and by the way, they're not using digital cameras. Uh-huh. They're all using real cameras and real film. Uh-huh. So one of the requests we had was to come to the City Hall area, the vicinity of this picture. We took a new photograph here, which hasn't been processed yet. It'll come next week. I'll show it to you. Now, this is where the City Hall is built now. It's under construction at this time. The railroad station had tracks, but only for freight trains. But this is the history of Los Angeles all over again.
Yeah.
This is, yeah, but today it's all the backgrounds filled with high-rise office buildings, dwarfing the City Hall.
And here's another one of the station.
That's in between. Yeah,
a year later, more or less, under construction.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And you still see City Hall.
Yeah.
And by the way, for photographers and architects too, in your photography, relate the building not to green, in this case, it's all steel and whatever, sky. But relate your building. Remember the previous photograph showed City Hall? Now we showed City Hall again to show you where it is in relationship to the station which is being erected. Now, the new picture we took was also, I found a place where you can see the City Hall again on the right side of my composition. On the left, we see the finished building. Mm-hmm. So those slides you'll see next week if you come back.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. This photo and also the previous one is also a very nice interaction between two buildings by the same architects. Both of them, City Hall and Union Station, are by John and Donald Parkinson, which is also a nice sort of like, I'm sure you did not do it for that reason, but a nice touch to the photo.
Yes, that's a good point you make, because when I began my work in the 30s, middle 30s, the architects working, Albert C. Martin, John Austin, Parkinson's, we had the beginning of a remarkable cycle of architects. Paul Williams was beginning then also. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up in my work with a great blessing that Neutra and Schindler, Gregory Yane, Harold Harris, Soriano, J.R. Davidson, I can name a dozen architects who were just young as I was. Everyone was beginning their careers. So here, that when I began, I got my homework done on the old buildings before the A.C. Martin, Soriano, and Neutra was here but not active. Rudolf Schindler was working with Frank Lloyd Wright. So my background, fortunately, as I say, it's a real blessing, because I was literally, physically trained to observe the beginning of contemporary architecture. Yeah. Today it's going wild all over the world.
Uh-huh. And you once told me about how interesting that early career was, like by working for one person, that person opened doors, in this case, then Richard Neutra opened doors for other architects, and just one led to the other. You did not really have to go out and advertise yourself that hard.
In those years, California Arts and Architecture magazine, which started the Case Study House program with John and Tenzer in the 1940s, 45, in that period of time. Uh-huh. So when I began working with Richard Neutra, by chance, I came down from Berkeley in 1935, at the end of 34 into 35, and I, by chance, after 2 weeks, I had met Richard Neutra by a coincidence, because I met a young man who was his new draftsman, new apprentice. And he took me to see the Neutra Kuhn House, which has been widely publicized because I took snapshots with my vest pocket camera. And he showed the prints I made to Mr. Neutra, who I never knew. I had never met an architect before I ever met Neutra. It's a strange, ironic, fateful incident in my life, which makes me feel very religious about my destiny. I never dreamed when I left Berkeley at the end of February in 1935. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I had been going to university 5 years at UCLA and 2 years at Berkeley. But I never registered. I was just... Don't laugh so loud, because I own the state of California a lot of money. But nonetheless, I met Neutra. He saw my photographs. He wanted to know who I was. Was I studying architecture? Was I studying photography? And I said, no, Mr. Neutra, I had just come down from Berkeley. I had spent 7 years at university. I never graduated. And by the way, when I speak to graduating classes, I rub it in a little bit. I said, look, you sucker. I mean, pardon me, you students. You go to school for 5 years and you're getting a piece of paper as a degree. And here I am, and this is in recent years, of course, where I'm making a lot of money with my work. And this year I got 3 doctorates from UCLA and USC and Woodbury University. My display thing in my studio, which you'll see if you come to visit me, I've got 3 certificates. Honor me as a doctor of whatever I'm called.
Okay, so we'll move on with some of the photos, because this also has a good story. You'll see upstairs there are a number of photographs that are sort of like panoramic photographs that we blew up to large size. This is the first photo you see when you come into the exhibition. And this is has a name, Rush Hour in Los Angeles.
Don't laugh. This is in June 1952. Florence McNeil, one of the editors of Time magazine, came out of here from New York. Time wanted to show the growth of Los Angeles. They heard about the rush hour traffic. So this is the Pasadena Freeway that emerges from the tunnel coming over the hills from Elysian Park area. There's downtown Los Angeles. On the left is my Chevy car used for my camera working equipment. You see there's a convenient turnout where I can park here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We chose the time because that's the rush hour. So we might set the camera here, City Hall in the background. By the way, the background now is filled with high-rise building, including the 73rd floor, the tallest building west of the Rockies from Colorado. So we waited for the rush hour. And finally, Florence said, "Julius, we got another assignment we want to do while the sun's shining. Let's wait to get enough cars together. You count, there's five cars. Uh-huh. That's the rush hour."
Yeah. Things have changed, as you see. Why don't we go on to the next photo? Because this is another one of those photos in the exhibition where you can see changes over time. This one, and maybe why don't we skip immediately then also to the next one?
That's
see,
this
is
in the background.
The same photo, basically, taken from more or less the same place. It must have been on Mulholland, or not?
The City Hall is practically buried. You can't see it anymore.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
This is what's... And since then, we've had that new... what was called the Library Tower.
Uh-huh.
It's 73 stories high, the tallest building in Western United States.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be come out in the next photograph we take in this area.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So was this a photo that was commissioned, or you were just hiking and took out your camera and took the picture?
I always took environmental photographs, Los Angeles, because at that time I was active with the AIA.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And I tried to help them, encourage architects to include the environmental photographs of their architecture, not just show a high-rise building, but to show where the high-rise Los Angeles. This is Hollywood in the foreground.
Mm-hmm.
I have other photographs of Wilshire Boulevard from Beverly Hills.
Why don't we actually look at something like that?
No, the back.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
This is a more primitive photograph looking down more towards the southwest. Hollywood is immediately
right,
in front of us.
Uh-huh. But you also do see downtown there with the building with the strange top on it. Yeah.
That's right. And you see the gas tanks there.
Yeah. That also, yeah. Uh-huh.
These are historical buildings, but we choose the right time of the day and the right time of the year to get this kind of photograph.
But also you used, infrared film.
Yes, this is probably infrared.
To get the dramatic effect with the clouds, but and also with the tree in the front and all.
Exactly.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Was that generally accepted?
They had no choice.
No, they had no choice. But I mean, your colleagues in the field. Good.
Uh-huh. You know, you give an architect a photograph of this magnificent sky.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Infrared film makes foliage white in the foreground, uh-huh, which is great for photography.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it cuts all the haze. Downtown Los Angeles is clear. But the main thing I want to get is a photograph which becomes iconic in terms of the growth of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
That middle distant street with high-rise buildings is Wilshire Boulevard.
Yeah.
You wouldn't recognize it today. It's filled with high-rise buildings.
Yeah.
So was downtown Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's move on then to look at some photos of specifically downtown Bunker Hill. We do not always think about now what happened that part of downtown where you now go to Disney Hall, to MoCA, to the cathedral, to the music center. But originally there were houses like that. And they were all taken down, right?
They were shot down. Mm-hmm. We have other photographs which we're not going to show tonight. There was a builder by the name of Fritz Burns, way before anyone's day in this audience, including you, Wim. Fritz Burns was a man who was smart. He had visions. He bought some of the old houses on 200 block South Flower Street, cleaned them up, refurbished them, and I knew the interior designer who did interiors.
Yeah.
He was going to sell these houses to business people who had offices and businesses downtown. Way before they destroyed all the old houses, these old two houses were long ago afterwards built and torn down. They were empty at that time. In the meantime, the Union Bank building by A.C. Martin was the first one of the first tall buildings beyond the City Hall, which was one of the tallest in Los Angeles at that time. It was a nice feeling to be able to be here and observe to photograph. And it's a blessing, I say, because I had no reason for having taken photographs like this. In those days, no person would give me an assignment to photograph a couple old shacky buildings. But my concern was to, inherently, I wanted to trace something about Los Angeles, the old and the new.
Yeah, exactly. And therefore, I want you to look very carefully at this photo, and then we go to the next one, which is not a Julius Juhlman photo. And I thought it would be interesting to just look at it for a second and think about the difference. When you see this photo, you know immediately this is not Julius Juhlman. And I think then you need to think about what is so different. And one of them is, I think, Julius, I don't know if you agree, but you would never have this much foreground, so much dirt in the foreground that... you would find other ways. You would, your skies go very dramatically high up.
Or cut a branch off a tree and hold it.
To cover it. Exactly. Exactly. But this is actually a photo from the library here, which is upstairs in the exhibition. You will also be able to see a small monitor with something like 65 photos from the archives relating to the same sites that you can see in the exhibition. And this is one of them. And so I think it's interesting. You would not take a photo where that one block house blocks the music center, the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion.
Yes, I would.
Not this way. Would you? Okay.
Yes. Because the design of the music center was okay, but it wasn't my cup of tea.
Yeah.
To me, it was more important to show the environment.
Yeah.
This is my equivalent of a green scene, because the house on the left is the one that's the castle in the other photograph on the right.
Yeah.
The salt box is the one on the right here, but it's actually on the left. These are the same two pictures, two houses which appeared before. They had moved them here on the way to move them away from the City Hall.
We're going to go to Heritage Square, but some of them did not survive the move, or very soon after the move, were burned down, right?
These two houses did burn down.
Yeah,
Just as well, they weren't worth saving.
I think if you would fix them up, you could make something good out of it.
Well, the lumber was good.
Okay. Well, let's look at another downtown photo. It's this here. So this gives another good idea. So what you just saw was you now see all the cars parked right in front of the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. But that site now is taken up by Disney Hall. So that gives a very good idea of how much has changed. Here on this side on the right, there's now MoCA there, the music school. And
that's
this
right.
Here
this is Grand Avenue on the right foreground. A little while ago, I just turned off the freeway onto Temple Street, and we came down Grand Avenue. It's a shortcut.
Okay, I'll remember that for next time. but so I'm sure nobody really asked you to take a photo of what downtown looked like at that time, this bare area where all the residents that had been there were all removed. It looked very desolate.
It was desolate because they had moved all the old buildings away from Bunker Hill. By the way, a city hall on the very far right.
Yeah.
It's the opposite direction that we photographed City Hall from the beginning of the Union Terminal Station.
Yeah.
There in the background, you can see Mount Baldy above the City Hall with the snow on it, where I used to go skiing. Then there's the San Gabriel Mountains, and there's the Dodger Stadium back on the right, on the left here.
Yeah.
And here's the apartment building.
And that's the Union Bank Tower there in the middle.
That's right. So in other words, this is the beginning of Los Angeles. Today, in the next series of pictures I take downtown, I'll be on the top of the same building here. We're going to show this all completely inundated with high-rise buildings. You won't be, you'll hardly will see City Hall. You certainly won't see the Music Center.
Yeah.
It's all being blocked by that
other
many high-rise
tall buildings.
Buildings.
Which do you remember? Which building you were standing on?
First International Trust. It's now something else. See, these buildings in Los Angeles changed name.
It's not the Arco Towers, right?
No.
Whatever it is,
AT&T,
this
somebody
called,
says,
it was the highest building in Los Angeles at that time. I was able to, oh, by the way, for those of you who are photographers, you come into a building nowadays as high security. And I walk in with my camera and my assistant, we're carrying our equipment, 4x5 camera on the view. I look important. So we come to the guard and he says, "Can I help you?" I said, "Oh, I've been asked by the mayor, whoever he was at that time." He wants us to take a study of Los Angeles, how it appears from a high-rise building. And we understand, we chose your building. You think it's possible for us to come on the roof of the building? Oh, sure. Mayor Bauer at that time was, whoever he was, a mayor.
A
good friend, so we had access. And by the way, too, as an aside, I was photographing Century City, West Los Angeles. And they're building the Delta, the two high-rise buildings with a D-shaped building like that. And I found a place around Santa Monica Boulevard where the Mormon Temple is situated. And I drove in there and asked the attendant. I said, "We're photographing Century City, and we want to get a picture because it was a clear day. Between the two towers, you can see Mount Baldy covered with snow, which is there on the right side here. Imagine many miles to the west, a view of the city with the framing with the Century City buildings in the foreground. Oh, that building that you want to get up on the roof is restricted. Are you a Mormon?" I said, "No, I'm Jewish." He said, "Well, that's fine." I was nonplussed. I don't know why he said that. Well, I'm not an Orthodox Jewish person or Israelite or whatever, but I knew a little bit that the 12 tribes of Israel represented those tribes that disappeared and escaped from Egypt. There was a 13th tribe that was missing. He said, "We Mormons think that we're the 13th tribe of Israel. That's why the Mormons and Israelis have gotten together so well, because here I am, a little 12-year-old, well, 15, 20-years-old Jewish boy, coming into a Mormon temple, being blessed by the fact that I'm a member of the 13th tribe." So, we had the same experience of getting into a building that was restricted.
Again, look very carefully at this photo. Now we look at the next one, because this is a photo taken at exactly the same time, but taken in a way which Julius imagines what the city was going to look like. Everything around there was still empty.
Naked. But,
pardon?
Naked.
Naked. Okay. But you were creating an image for the city here.
The tall building in the middle of the picture, where this walkway leads to, yeah. That's the building. I was on the roof of that building. Courtesy of Mayor Bowen. Whatever it was. Water and Power building is on the right.
That's, to the right here, yeah.
The Music Center is on the left.
Uh-huh, yeah. But you were able to present an incredible photo of one. If you would send this photo, would have sent this photo to your friends outside town, nobody would have guessed what this part of town actually looked like.
Not
and
today.
That's what you.
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You couldn't see these buildings because where my fingers are where all the high-rise buildings loom up into the sky.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, one more. We've talked so much about City Hall. Now we have two views down City Hall on the whole Civic Center. But this is, again, a building, shows a building that we do not remember anymore. It was called the New Hall of Records.
That's right.
Which is placed very strangely in within the grid of the whole city.
It was strange because the early architects who developed the old buildings around Los Angeles were very much site conscious. And this building is cattywampus to the Criminal Records building on the right. It's a criminal courts in that building on the right. They built it close to the Hall of Records, which was slated for this demolishment. It's too bad because today architects look at this old building of the City Hall, and I mean the Hall of Records, and they say, my God, that's a beautiful building. Why did they destroy it? Mm-hmm. Well, you can ask the architects or whoever it was responsible for destroying it.
Uh-huh.
But that, we won't go into that tonight.
Yeah, well, if you see what time. Happened after the next photo, here it is. The building is gone because it really did not fit in this whole plan for this big park that we are still working on now between the Music Center and City Hall.
The Hall of Record, the Water and Power building is on the right. When is this?
It's straight ahead. Yeah. Uh-huh.
This is from the 15th floor of the Hall of Records.
This is not taken from City Hall?
No, Hall of Records. Oh. Oh, no, pardon me, City Hall.
Yeah, okay.
I'm sorry, yes, yeah. 15th
uh-huh.
floor.
Yeah. Okay, so time flies, actually. Let's see. Why don't we? I want to show one more photo that I think is a surprise. If we could go, Christopher, to the photo of Park La Brea. This comes right after the May Company. I had lots to talk about, as you can see. But you can hear this one. This is.
Wait a minute, hold it just for a second. Huh? Let's go back to the May Company.
Go back to the May Company, okay. Yeah, that's actually very good. Okay.
I'll show you something, the story of my life. Here I am at Christmas time, and A.C. Martin wanted me to get a photograph of the May Company building. They didn't have signals in those days. See the traffic cop on the right side?
Yeah, uh-huh.
And see the no left turn signs in the middle of the...
Yeah, uh-huh.
So I set my camera, 4x5 camera, a tripod. I found this composition. I put my film in there, 4x5 film. And I walked across the street to where the policeman was. And I said to him, oh, I wonder if you can help me.
Never heard it.
Please, sir. my camera's over there. The mayor asked me... He wants me to show. He wants to show how Los Angeles is growing, uh-huh. And Fairfax and Wilshire Boulevard was an important building. Uh-huh. I didn't say the architect wanted a picture of the building.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Come back on Sunday, he would say.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to get some traffic around. It was dressed. The window. See the Christmas trees on the right.
Yeah.
It was Christmas time. A lot of traffic. So would you mind, I'm going to go back to my camera, I've got the film in place. When I wave at you, will you stop the traffic? You notice the camera, the cars are standing still?
Yeah.
See the wheels on the left, middle right, far right, and one car sneaked through here on the right. Huh?
But
he was okay.
That one car actually is fantastic because of that movement, it feels like the building is moving towards you.
Exactly. Well, almost was.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This becomes a classic building of the May Company building. Yeah. And I took my exposure, click, and waved the man, blew his whistle, traffic resumed. So there's an example again. You got to remember not to be afraid to approach a policeman and say, please, sir.
These things have changed a little bit, I think. You wouldn't do that anymore. Anyway, so let's look at that last photo here. Because this is Park La Brea before LACMA. So the May Company is right to the left of this appliances building. This appliances building is where right now Renzo Piano is building the new wing, the Eli Broad wing. And so LACMA is there. The tar pits you cannot see.
That's right.
But this also, I thought, is an incredible photo to show you how much the city has changed in those 40, 50 years. This is a photo.
What year was that dated?
51. So it's already past 8 o'clock, so I also want to give all of you an opportunity to ask questions. But before we do that, I want to do two things. First of all, I want to thank Christopher, the co-curator, who is in the back there and has been moving. And then we're going to move Julius a little bit so that he can see you when you ask your questions.
Gordon's on his way.
Oh, okay, yeah. So shall I change you a little bit more? Move.
That's close enough.
Yeah?
Here we go.
Is it okay?
We're in good shape now.
Okay, great. So,
right.
And I'm going to also move my chair closer.
Now, what we'd like to find out, yes, you can tell me how good I am as a photographer. It's okay, it's important. Because those of you in the audience who have anything to do with photography and architecture and environment, don't talk about green, but talk about everything else. In other words, what makes Los Angeles such a great city?
So who has the first question? Okay. Wait for the microphone, please.
Did you do any color photography while you were doing some of these pictures?
Silly boy.
Thank you.
Is there anything else?
I don't want to embarrass you, but I just came out with three books from Toshin, Modernism Rediscovered, which are filled with color photography. And my color photography, seriously, does go back to the 1930s and 40s. See, in my early years, there were five architectural photographers of prominence in the United States. Ezra Stoller in New York, Hedrick Blessing in Chicago, Delrick Meisel in Dallas, Texas, Roger Sturvent in San Francisco, and Uncle Julius in the foreground. There were five of us, and there were not many. Few architects ever you hired a commercial photographer, other than the fact that there's no modern architecture photographers. In fact, the five I mentioned were the pioneers. I was perhaps the oldest of all of them. I still am. The others are dead by now. So it's a blessing.
Next question. Next question.
Next.
This could be directed to either one of you. I'm wondering about the connection between architectural photography and general art photography. Yeah. And I was sort of surprised at the beginning when it was said that these are in the research section of Getty rather than the photographic center.
Okay, well, I'll ask Julius to answer the question first and I'll add some things. So the question is, what is the relationship between architecture photography and art photography?
One of the reasons why I'm pretty well preserved at the age of 97. There's no birthday cake here now. We'll get that there. But anyhow, in elementary school, when I was a farm boy, I was outdoors a great deal of time, came to California, I joined the Boy Scouts. Hiking and camping, I've been on the top of every one of the San Gabriel Mountain peaks, including Mount Baldy, Gorgonio, San Jacinto. I've hiked all over Southern California. I was a gymnast in high school. I was also on the track team. So I took good care of myself. I believed in good exercise and outdoor living. So as a result, when I began to do photography, I was conscious of the outdoors, and I knew Los Angeles. So therefore, in my compositions, I always made a point to show the city or any other building in relationship to a prominent building I was doing for an architect, whether it's Century City or whatever part of the city I was photographing. The picture I took of the mobile gas building on the corner of Wilshire, 6th Street and Flower Street, I showed that with a wide-angle lens to show the full length of the building and the environment around it. That building now is occupied by 300 condominiums. It used to be an office building. Now it's a loft building. Los Angeles has become a miracle of growth. All the old buildings, which are empty office buildings, are now occupied by people living in downtown Los Angeles. So the environmental photograph I'm asked for to identify is part of my every day, breathing in and breathing out. Mm-hmm. I like to look at the environment.
Mm-hmm. But maybe also another, do you hear me? Yeah, okay. Another way of looking at it, at this question is, do you think of yourself as an artist, photographer, or as a businessman?
Oh, I'm always called a great artist, and I agree. But on the other hand, Toshin, when he was doing publicity of one of my books, sent a copy of the book to Art Center magazine in New York. It's an art magazine. The critics for the magazine wrote, if Julia Shulman's buildings were Grace Kelly, the person chose a beautiful person because I like Grace Kelly. Anyhow, if these buildings, Julia Shulman buildings were Grace Kelly, they would represent her beauty, her dignity, her gracefulness, her elegance as a person. This person, the Art Critic magazine, was recognizing the art aspect of my photography. Mm-hmm. And here's an art critic for an art magazine. And I don't look at art magazines because I don't believe in art. I believe in my photography.
I will also add very quickly to this answer to your question, that the Research Institute is a place where we do research about all kinds of expressions of art and architecture. And so the archive is very much used as a research tool. There are also some Julius Shulman photographs in the photo collection at the museum. However, the archive, in the end, we decided, and it was really a decision between the museum and us, would be better in our place because we are really set up to deal with dozens of people who call every week. We get requests for a Julia Shulman photo every day, at least one. And the museum would not be able to handle that. So that also answered that question. Are there more questions? Oh, yes. Lady in the black, this sweater.
Yes, I'm interested to know if the other photographs in the archives can be seen by the public?
Yes, in other exhibitions. If you have a good reason to come see photos for a research project, for something you're writing, for whatever reason, you can call our reference librarians and you can set up an appointment, but you need to know what you want to see exactly. You cannot say, oh, I just want to see all the photographs he took in 1954. That's so much, we can't do that. That's more than we can handle. But if you say, pardon?
No, let me get around that. I don't believe in that.
Well, but it's the truth.
Now, what I will tell you all, which is good, if you want to identify any building that may be in my archives.
That was the next thing I wanted to say. Okay.
But I'll tell you how to get around this guy.
Okay.
All right. What we do is this. You come to my place and see my home and studio. By the way, I chose a piece of property on Woodrow Wilson Drive where Laurel Canyon meets Mulholland. Woodrow Wilson Drive begins there. It's a little narrow street. And I found a 2-acre piece of land, which I bought in 1947 for $2,000. You realize what 2 acres would cost today? It's nothing. There's a large property. So I built my home and studio there, and I built a tremendous garden. And behind me is all empty land where we keep our wild animals, a lot of animals. Now, if you want to see my house and studio, you're welcome to come weekends if you want to. Give me a call. Call this guy for the phone number.
He's in the phone book.
Yeah. Now, if you really genuinely want to study some of the work that I have in my archives, you come to the studio, let me know what buildings you'd like to see, and I'll have a directory. If I have it in my file, I'll give you the job number. The job number, simultaneously, is adjacent to the numbers that are in the Getty files. Getty has a great staff. They're working literally day and night to file it, to administer it. So you will be able to, I'll give you the job number, because every picture I have has its own number. Then you call Getty, tell them what you want, make an appointment, and God bless you.
And we'll help as much as possible. We do. The gentleman behind.
This will be our last question.
Okay.
Yes, you told us a lot of wonderful stories, but is there one that really stands out?
Is there one story that really stands out that you haven't told us yet?
Well, if you want to hear my stories...
Come for a drink.
No, don't wait, don't leave yet. You'll have to... There may be some sandwiches left in the other room. I usually give 2 hours for a program, but tonight we'll cut it short. But in all seriousness, what can I tell you? For example, here's a man like Schindler, who was a compatriot of Neutra in Austria. Schindler came to the United States in 1914. He went to Chicago, where he had met Frank Lloyd Wright and began to work with him. But he also went back into Chicago, and unbeknownst to most people, Schindler was a good photographer. Somebody at the UC Santa Barbara found a box of photographs on one of these shelves. Mm-hmm. It said R.M. Schindler, 1914. Schindler used to walk around Chicago photographing with his little camera, black and white, of course, all the old buildings around Chicago, Adler and all those other famous pioneers. Schindler didn't realize it, that this man in the LA, in the Santa Barbara Museum Art School, had a collection of rare photographs of downtown Chicago. And walking in the foreground, you see women dressed in this long, high-heeled long dresses and the men wearing coats, ties, and derby hats. It's a history of architecture and environment. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. Mm-hmm. To me, that was important because I like to feel that in my photography, and Schindler, without realizing it, had earmarked what Chicago was like in 1914. Mm-hmm. I was only 4 years old at that time. And those pictures haven't been shown yet. And the fellow who has it now lives in Long Beach. He's going to arrange an exhibit sometime in the near future.
And a book, I think.
Possibly a book. Yeah. Uh-huh. Be wonderful.
So, thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you, Julius.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.